Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. So what would your life be like if you were as immersed in nature as you are in your electronic devices? According to my guest today, we'd be healthier, happier, have fewer cases of depression, anxiety, and attention deficit disorder. We'd also develop better relationships with ourselves and others and build smarter, more sustainable communities that would help end the loneliness epidemic in America. We'll also find out why Richard Loof compares raccoons to Seattle and Silicon Valley technophiles. Richard Loof is a journalist and author of 10 books. He's the co-founder and chair emeritus of the nonprofit Children and Nature Network, which supports a new nature movement through partnerships with such organizations as the National League of Citizens. In 2008, he was awarded the Audubon Medal presented by the National Audubon Society. That's a really prestigious award. Prior recipients have included Rachel Carson, E.O. Wilson, Sir David Attenborough, and President Jimmy Carter. Richard's written 10 books, as I said. His latest is called Our Wild Calling: How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Here's my conversation with Richard Loof. Well, first of all, Richard, I want to welcome you to Conversations Live. I've come across your work before, and so really excited to get the opportunity of talking with you today about your new book, Our Wild Calling. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And since we haven't talked before, I always like to get to know a little of the background about how you got into this kind of work. You're a journalist. You're the author of 10 books on nature and humans and our place and connection in the world. How did this all begin for you? Were you one of those little kids who was always out in nature playing around? How did it begin?
Yes, actually I was a kid once. And I spent a lot of my boyhood in the woods near our house, and my dog Banner knew where I was, but my parents often did not. So that was me.
That was you. And so then what made you decide to make a career of writing about nature, immersing yourself in this topic?
Well, most of my career as a journalist, as a newspaper columnist and so forth, I covered trends, just general trends. One of those trends that kept popping up was this relationship between humans and the natural world and how it was changing, particularly for children. But the last four books now have focused specifically on that changing relationship, and the new in Our Wild Calling focuses on animals.
Okay. So, and this book is, the full title is Our Wild Calling: How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. I want to begin by paraphrasing a quote about the book that says, "Our wild calling redefines the future of human and animal coexistence. It explores the powerful and mysterious bonds between animals and man and how they can transform our mental, physical, and spiritual lives." Now, often when we set out to write a book, we may have a theme in mind, and it kind of evolves as we get into the research. Is this what you had in mind when you set out, or is this one of those stories that gradually evolved?
Well, it's complicated. this has been my hardest book to write. I spent 4 years on it, and it's probably a lesson in never start a book based on a feeling.
Right.
But that's how this began. It was this feeling I had when I would encounter wild animals, but also the feeling I had about my dog Banner when I was a kid. And I didn't think it had a name, this feeling. I didn't think it had been fully explored, particularly with wild animals. And so it took me 4 years in collecting many, many stories from people about their relationships, not only with their pets, but also with wild animals, even if it was just a few seconds of an encounter. And out of those stories really came the answer, or what I hope is the answer, to the question I was asking about that feeling.
And did you feel that you got that answer? I mean, did you feel personally satisfied that you found that answer by the end of the book?
Well, that's a great question. I felt personally satisfied that I got as close as I could.
Right.
And there may be people, and it is a, you know, I often say this is not new. Indigenous people have focused on this forever, and our ancestors knew it and could define it and describe it. But, you know, I got as close as I could, and it takes a few words yet to explain that. But mainly it's through these stories. They illustrate it, and they all have themes that they seem to have in common. And it doesn't matter whether it's a hardcore scientist or a kid growing up in a neighborhood in Vancouver. They all seem to have something of the same experiences.
Right. And you, let's talk about some of the people you talked with, because you talked with a huge range of people and share some great stories in the book that they shared, and anecdotes too. You talked with researchers, theologians, you talked with wildlife experts, indigenous healers, psychologists. How did you select who you talked to?
It's like most journalism, one thing leads to another, one person leads to another. I did want to have a broad array, a real diverse mix of people, both professionally and also cultures. So I did select based on that, but you know, people know people, and they tell you about other people that have talked to them. One of the odd things that I found was that in telling me these stories of these encounters, particularly with wild animals, people were sometimes, I was the first person they told that story to, and they felt a little bit embarrassed about, perhaps because they might be accused of anthropomorphism or romanticizing animals or something like that, or being, you know, too new age or whatever. And I was described recently in Outside Magazine as a little new agey, which is a first in my life because I grew up in Kansas. I've never been called new agey.
Right, right.
I'll live with that. It's okay.
Right.
You know, these stories, but it wasn't only the stories. There is a lot of science, not enough, but there is science that backs up what these stories are illustrating.
And one of those stories that it was with Molly Matteson. You talked with Molly Matteson, and she was she's a wildlife biologist who went on a vision quest and was looking for answers and didn't really believe what she saw during her vision quest, and didn't tell anybody about it for a long time because here she is a scientist and she's kind of poo-pooed this kind of thing before. Would you share that story with us?
Well, this is not common among wildlife biologists, but she was at a point in her life that many things were happening in her life, and she found herself through an organization going on a vision quest. This involved going out into the desert and sitting and waiting for many, many hours. I don't think there's a lot of eating that happened. There wasn't. It was sensory deprivation, I'm sure, but she was focused on bats, and or at least that came later. And she had some bones of a bat with her, and she began to, after quite a long time, she began to perhaps hallucinate, and she kept seeing eyes out on the desert and out in the mountains and all around her, and she realized that she was looking at the eyes of bats. Now, one can dismiss that as hallucination or something else, but that had a profound effect on her. She became focused on what's called white nose disease among bats, which is forcing some bat species into extinction and or close to it. And so for the rest of her career, she is focused on the science of that, on the hard science of saving bats from that disease. So that kind of encounter, which was not necessarily with a live animal, which most of them are, it changed her life.
Right.
Many of these stories talk about how it changed the trajectory of careers, changed how they dealt with their families, their spouses, and changed their sense of being alive.
Right, right. There is scientific evidence, at least we're seeing more and more of it now. I've talked with several wildlife experts over the years. I've talked with photographers like Joel Sartori and National Geographic, and we're starting to get more science proving that that human-animal connection is really important to our health and well-being. One of the things that you talk about a lot is that you hope by creating this connectedness with animals and nature, we're going to tear ourselves away from that inevitable screen that we stare at all day long, right?
Well, it even goes beyond that. We're going to provide more support for our own survival, and certainly for the survival of other species. If I could tell you a quick story that illustrates this connection.
Right.
And this is one of the few that I tell in the story that are my own stories. And I was on a lake once near San Diego, and I was watching the shore. I was there alone, had a very quiet electric motor. I saw what I thought were two vultures on the shore, and I eased up to them with my electric motor, and they were not vultures. They were two giant golden eagles. I got within about 20 feet of them. Usually don't get within 20 feet of the golden eagles. And I stayed there, and they, over time, stayed there. And for what seemed like forever, and I'll explain that that's important later, but what seemed like forever, they would reach down and take a bite of the fish they were eating, and then they would look up at me. Their eyes seldom looked away. We did that for a long time. And I know this sounds strange to some people, but I felt something important happen there. And I can't speak for the eagles. They may just have been trying to figure out if I was edible.
Right.
Something happened in me, or more specifically, between the eagles and me.
Right.
I went home and I told my son, who was home from college, that story. And I said, you know, the feeling I have, Matthew, is whoever I say I am, I'm not. Whoever I was in those moments is actually who I am. And I don't have the words to explain that. I looked for the answer to that through all of these stories, talking to scientists, talking to theologians, all this. One way to look at this connection, is, you know, the great philosopher Martin Buber, and I always have to be careful not to say Justin Bieber.
Right.
Martin Buber wrote a great essay called I and Thou, and it was about people. Basically, he said, you and I don't exist. What exists is between us. It's a relationship. Without that, we don't really exist. He thought of relationship a little differently than most people. He thought of it literally as a kind of electricity that some people call God. That's what I felt with those eagles. That's what so many of the people who told me their stories felt, something like that. I decided, you know, that thing between me and the eagles, it has no name. And so in the book, I call that the habitat of the heart. I believe that there are two habitats. There's the physical habitat that we work so hard, many of us, to try to protect for the sake of wildlife and ourselves. And then there's the other habitat, the habitat of the heart, and that is what is between us and other life. We don't do very much at all to preserve and grow the habitat of the heart, but here's the deal. Those two habitats, physical habitat, habitat of the heart, if one of those goes, so does the other. We're facing mass extinctions right now with many species. I think the key to, or one of the keys, to preventing the all of that in the future getting much, much worse is in the habitat of the heart. We need to pay attention to that in addition to the physical habitat.
Yes. Yes, I know in your book you talked with several philosophers who kind of avoid the word magic, but there's a magic kind of connection there. I had one myself with a deer once. As we were coming around a corner, And we almost bumped into each other, and we both were startled and kind of jumped back a step and then just stayed there for what seemed like the longest time. And then I stepped to one side to let him come through, and he just walked through. But it stayed with me for a long time, and I definitely felt a connection there, so I understand that. You just mentioned, you know, we're heading towards another mass extinction. I think it's been written about a lot. We've done a couple of shows on it. I read in your book that since 1970, from 1970 through 1970 through 2014, our global wildlife population shrank by 60%. That's a huge amount. Are we seeing that stop, or is it increasing even more?
Well, you know, Rachel Carson, in the great book, Silent Spring, her first chapter described a neighborhood in which no one could hear birds anymore. That chapter actually led to my first book, which is Last Child in the Woods, a future in which kids aren't out in the woods anymore. There's a new study that came out a couple months ago that showed that since 1970, just 50 years, almost 30% of wild birds in North America have disappeared.
Wow.
Some 3 billion birds gone. How can we let that continue? If that continues, who will sing to us?
Mm. Yeah, I can't think of anything worse, really, than not having, you know, not waking up to birds in the spring and hearing them chirp while you're down by the river and places like that.
Right, and I think that the importance of this is what I've tried to communicate in our wild calling, because this isn't just about us. This is about us being healthier and feeling more alive and telling our stories about that, just as you told me that great story about the deer.
Mm.
This is about the survival of species. This is about them, too. And, you know, I want to make that clear. This isn't just to make us feel good.
Right, right. I want to look at a couple of the things you talk about, and I've been interested in myself, especially how dogs can teach children ethical behavior. I think dogs can teach us an abundance of lessons, like how to be in the moment, how to be joyful, you know, how to have a joyful spirit, basically, how to appreciate the small things in life. How do they teach our children ethical behavior? You say that comes from their wolf ancestry.
Yeah, I showed a friend of mine old home movies of my dog Banner. It was a collie. He was a collie. And her comment was, that dog is having entirely too much fun. and so was I. And with Banner, and I tell this story, I always had the sense that he taught me some ethics. And when I said that to an animal behavioralist, I based this on things that Banner did to protect me, to protect smaller dogs in the neighborhood, to protect a lady up the street who was about to be attacked by another dog. He did remarkable things. He also was a kind of older brother to me, and even though we were about the same age. I mentioned that to an animal behavioralist, who immediately dismissed me, said, ethics, forget about that. You're just romanticizing your dog. Well, I didn't agree with him. But while I was doing the research for this book, I looked into where dogs came from. And obviously, all dogs come eventually from gray wolves. And there's a couple theories about how that happened. One is that we domesticated gray wolves. We threw bones out beyond our fires, and the gray wolves came close, and we eventually became closer. The other theory, and I think actually both of these are probably true, the other theory is that gray wolves domesticated us. These German researchers wrote about this, and I quote them, that we probably followed their packs as they hunted, and we saw teamwork at play. We saw them cooperating. We watched their families from a distance and saw how good they were to each other. Wolves have great families.
Mm.
In other words, we were being taught ethics and adding those ethics to our own ethics that we're developing. The researchers actually use that word ethics, so I felt justified right. in the eyes of that animal behaviorist who dismissed me.
Right, right. I want to talk about an animal that is either loved or vilified, I found, at least in my experience, and that's the raccoon. You say, and I want to just paraphrase this from the book. I'm actually going to quote it from the book. You write, some young technophiles in Silicon Valley and Seattle, because we're based in Seattle, right, refer to themselves with pride as neophiliacs because they adjust quickly to change, reflect the routine or traditional, become bored easily, and exhibit a need to create novelty or stir up social unrest. In other words, your basic raccoon with computer programming skills. High-tech cities may be attracting people and animals who share the same traits. Talk to us about the raccoon, because I have found people either love them or they hate them.
I know, that's very true. And so, and that's in a section of the book called The Betweens, and it's about the huge number of wild animals that are moving into cities, including Seattle and many other cities. There's, you know, for some time there have been coyotes in Central Park in New York. There are pictures of coyotes, by the way, riding public transit in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
And in Chicago. The wildlife biologists who study these animals call them neophiles, and it's because they're attracted to the new. And that's why raccoons, crows, coyotes, and a number of other animals, including bears now, are attracted more and more to cities, sometimes just at the edge, but sometimes they go all the way into the cities. And so raccoons are neophiles, just like some of the folks being attracted to the high-tech industries. And I love raccoons myself. We moved up into the mountains east of San Diego recently, and so we've had a lot of raccoons on our roof and under our house. And I'll get up in the middle of the night, and I'll hear them. I'll look in the backyard, and one will be standing up looking at me and approaching me, and I hold my ground behind the glass. And I think, you know, sometimes I think they're about to flip me off. And I love the raccoons. I like their bad attitude.
They definitely have attitude. I read that you wrote this book up in the Cuyamaca Hills, and I used to live in San Diego, so I'm very familiar with that whole area. And yes, it has an abundance of raccoons up there.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've had, I mean, here in Seattle, which is a very built-up, King County's very built-up area now, as you know, and we had just a few weeks ago a cougar on Mercer Island. So he either swam across the lake to Mercer Island, or he toddled across the freeway bridge, which nobody really knows. But he was.
I heard about that recently when I was speaking in Chicago. I mean, in Seattle.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, what are some? Give us some tips for people who are in neighborhoods that want to create wildlife watch groups that protect this kind of situation, because there's a tendency, you know, for us to want to get rid of the animal and, you know, might be harmful, but there again, it might not. What are some tips you'd give to people in areas where we have this encroachment? Because, I mean, ultimately, we're encroaching on their land. We took their land from them.
Well, I think you mentioned wildlife watch groups. I suggest near the end of the book that we form something in our neighborhoods to deal with the influx of wildlife. Similar to Neighborhood Watch, which looks for criminals. But in this case, it would be wild watch groups that would learn about and watch and tell stories to each other about and record the existence of wild animals and as well as domestic animals in their neighborhoods. And the focus would be on two results. One is to protect those wild animals, because a lot of people would like to exterminate them. But the other purpose would be to protect people, our neighbors, from certain wild animals that might not be good for people. That might, one particular one might be carrying a zoonotic disease. Another one might be too aggressive, a coyote that too many people have fed. So it's become too used to us. So these wildlife watch groups would do both, protect animals and protect people. But in the doing of that, they would create, improve their own social capital with each other and with the rest of the animal life in their neighborhood. Why is it when we talk about social capital, we only talk about one species, us? I think we need to begin to include the many animals, the other life in our neighborhoods, in that definition of social capital. And I think that as they do that, one of the most important things we can do is tell stories to each other, just like the one that you told me. I found over time that the people who told me those stories, sometimes they were embarrassed, but the more they told their stories to more and more people, the more meaning they personally found in those stories, and they don't forget them. And also to be aware of our loneliness. That's one of the themes in the book, which is medical folks are now saying that we are in an epidemic of human loneliness that is about to surpass obesity as a cause of early death, not only because of suicide, but because of the diseases that are associated with loneliness. I think that that is, you know, a lot of people like to blame Facebook, et cetera, but I think it's deeper than that. I think this loneliness is not only human, it is rooted in species loneliness, our desperate sense that we're alone in the universe. The urban parks that have the highest benefit for human psychological health happen to be the ones with the highest biodiversity. I don't think that's an accident. We need other animals. We need to communicate with them. We need to know them. And, you know, this communication is all around us. I describe it as a kind of a ring of intimacy that's around us all the time that we usually don't even notice, but it's there. And we need to pay attention to it.
Right, right. I love where I live purely for the landscape, because when I walk my dog, I often see seals and sea otters, and I see a little kingfisher nearly every day, and I see blue herons and bald eagles, and I so appreciate it. But I find that a lot of people don't even look up. They're either on their phone or they're just walking, looking down at the ground. And if we just stop a moment and look around us, there's a whole world out there that's waiting to embrace us. I want to just touch on this very quickly because I know we're running short on time here, but one of the things, talking about loneliness, and you know, when we're coming from a place of loneliness, we're really, you know, it's kind of a fear-based emotion. And according to Mark Beckoff in your book, he says, as people become more isolated and fearful, so do our dogs. And I can definitely see that because they pick up on our emotions so much. What do you have to say to that?
Well, part of it is because the dogs are isolated from other dogs. It's one of the really important things about walking dogs and letting them say hello to the other dogs, sniff them and all of that. In doing that, it also makes us healthier. That's one of the reasons why dogs probably lengthen many of our lives. But I think that's another example of species loneliness. We're not we may be the loneliest or one of the loneliest species, but we're not the only lonely species. I also want to add that, you know, what I'm talking about, these connections with other animals, the story you told, that can be dismissed as ESP or some kind of spiritual thing, and I happen to believe it is spiritual. But there's also science behind that. More and more, as you know, more and more information now is about the intelligence and the communication skills of other animals. They have an incredible amount of communication going on, some of which we can understand, and it's not always sound. Sometimes it's behaviors. There's a guy in the Bay Area that's teaching people how to learn bird language. He takes them out into the forest, hundreds of them, and they learn bird language. And he says they go home. And this bird language, again, is not just sound. It's patterns. It's all kinds of things. They go home, and they come back to John, and they report, you know, I seem to be getting along better with my wife. And it says it could be because you're listening to her. You're paying attention to her. Right. You're noticing. And that's one of the skills that is increased when we begin to notice all the life around us.
Right, definitely. What surprised you most during your research for the book, Richard?
Well, there's so many things. I mean, that's one of the reasons the book was hard. I went into territory I thought I knew a lot about but didn't. But I think the main thing that surprised me is how deeply people feel about their stories, about their encounters, about their pets, about the raccoon in the backyard, about the coyote they had direct eye contact with, or even the acorn woodpeckers that are on their balcony. They feel deeply about this and sometimes don't even know it. And they do sense that we are part of a much larger family. And by recognizing that, we do feel more alive and we feel less isolated.
Mm, important. And I know that you're passionate about getting children involved in this. So would you talk to us very briefly about Children and Nature Network that you founded?
Oh, thanks for mentioning that. Children and Nature Network is a nonprofit that grew out of Last Child in the Woods, which was about what I called nature deficit disorder. When that came out, I had a chapter near the end that imagined a movement emerging that would connect kids to nature, reconnect them. That was wishful thinking. The book came out, the phrase nature deficit disorder entered the language. In fact, it's entered some 24 languages now, one way or another. That's how many translations there are.
Yeah, nature deficit disorder.
It became a phenomenon, to my great surprise, and people started asking me, so now what do we do? Fortunately, some really good people came to my rescue, and together we formed the Children Nature Network. It's at childrenandnature.org, and if you go there, you can find what once were about 60 studies that have now expanded to about 1,000 studies about the benefits of nature for kids and adults. You can also find people all over the world who are working to connect children, their families, and their communities to the natural world, and I hope folks do go there.
Well, Richard Louv, I want to thank you for joining us today. Great book. I know a lot of hard work and love went into this book, a lot of research. The book is called Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. And you can find out more about Richard at richardlouv.com. And I want to thank everyone for joining us today. You can find us at conversationslive.net. You'll find more than 1,000 guests and more than 600 podcasts there. We publish a new podcast every Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.